Media piracy in the US and all over the world is still a pretty sensitive subject, often painted in black and white extremes. On the one side, you have content industries jealously guarding their property, striking back at pirates with all the force of their nearest justice system. And on the other side, you have pirates who hold no regard for the livelihood of those who toil to create the videos, music, and software that they copy and sell freely. If this week's unveiling of the anti-counterfeiting trade agreement is any indication, the lines in the battle over piracy are still very much drawn. But recent research on how pirate markets work is actually showing some benefits to media piracy. One album copied and distributed would usually be considered a sale lost for the artist and their label, under the established view anyway. However, while album sales have dropped, data shows that in some areas, music industry profits are skyrocketing, with merchandise and live performances more than making up the difference. Looking at things from this perspective, an enterprising artist might just want to give their music away for free, if that meant they could cash in at the shows. And it turns out that this actually is an established business practice for artists the world over. In South Africa and Brazil, for instance, many artists drop their albums on the pirate market, building a following that can pay out big for live shows. Joe Karaganis of the Social Science Research Council has studied how pirate markets for software, music, and film work around the globe. He joined us recently to talk about where media piracy can work and how pirates and industry might be able to reach a ceasefire.
Well, we began with really four questions. One was about the social costs and benefits of piracy. And we thought it was important to try and take a kind of holistic approach to understanding what piracy means in developing economies, where of course everybody was familiar with the with claims about the costs of piracy to U.S. industries, especially because the copyright industries in the U.S. had been so effective at not only conducting studies to demonstrate losses, but in sort of connecting that to public relations campaigns and really amplifying their account of what the impact of piracy was on their businesses.
And we're talking the software...
Software companies, record companies, movie companies, especially movie studios. And of course, from the perspective of developing countries, there are some real trade-offs. It's not purely a question of loss. In fact, it's... plausible to characterize a loss to U.S. industries as a gain to the developing countries. That is strongest in areas where the piracy is providing a critical information good, like software. To be a functional modern economy, you really have to have a software infrastructure that connects you with the rest of the world. And for most of the world, that's pirated copies of Microsoft Windows Office. It's less compelling a case in the context of record and movie piracy, where piracy of those goods really performs no crucial social need. But even there, we found some interesting kind of countervailing effects whereby, you know, part of the difficulty of the developing country cultural economies is that there's such constrained supply of legal goods at any price in many respects. So distribution infrastructures are very weakly developed. There are relatively few bookstores, movie theaters, record stores. The distribution infrastructure is often very underdeveloped. And in the case of records, there's a lot of local content. In the case of movies, there's almost no local content. For some kinds of goods, piracy is providing really the only available or the only convenient distribution infrastructure for people. So part of the lesson of the report, to the extent that there are lessons, is that piracy is a signal of a certain kind of market failure to provide the infrastructure for access to media. So people are exposed to media in different ways all the time, 24 hours a day. And in particular, they're exposed to the kinds of advertising campaigns that are very effectively deployed around the world and create desire for the next Hollywood movie or the next big album. And then they're sort of cut off from affordable, geographically manageable access to those goods.
It's as if a consumer is being told, this is the greatest, this is the next best thing, you have to check this out, and then there's no way for them to check it out.
Or, more often, no relatively easy way. It's always a question of comparative cost and convenience. So the people turn to piracy when the calculation of cost, that calculation of convenience just falls much too strongly the other way. And That's something we've found throughout, and it extends to questions of diversity as well. So very little diversity of offer, especially on the film side, where you know a handful of Hollywood hits are the really the only theatrical offerings in a given year. So we found that pirated channels are often performing a kind of cultural diversity function that was quite unexpected to us. We didn't think that was. We didn't anticipate that when we started the process.
When you're discovering these pirate markets, are you usually finding that they have a certain percentage of Hollywood or international content to this local diverse content that they're able to provide more legitimately?
It's really much more differentiated than we thought at the outset. So there are different markets in Johannesburg, for example, that cater to different portions of the population and stock different goods. There is a local market devoted mostly to Bollywood films, catering primarily to the South Asian communities in Johannesburg. There are more mass market street markets that cater mostly to middle class consumers and tourists, and that I should say they cater to. The kinds of goods that people who are more connected to the global media economy, and in particular the Western media, global media economy, want and don't have easy access to. They're integrated into a very strong, globally articulated system of commodity desire, to sort of put it in unnecessarily fancy terms. But the media companies have been enormously successful in building their brands and creating much larger potential markets for their goods than they actually serve in these countries. So when Lost comes out, it may not be available in South Africa or Australia for another 6 months or a year. And that portion of the population that is whose sense of identity as media consumers is linked to consumption of these global products is going to have a very strong incentive to buy it at the local market or to download it as soon as it becomes available.
Well, and there's an interesting way that you've just framed the debate that I'm curious what the industry has how they've responded to that, because the way that your research kind of frames it is there's a desire that's been created and a market that isn't yet available to meet that desire. Whereas the industry, in my uninformed view from what I've heard, is, you know, their kind of response is, well, you know, if there's a market out there that we're not controlling, it's an illegal market. It's a pirate market.
Yeah, certainly that's a fair characterization of the dominant industry position to date, I would say. Now, as we try and document in the report, that is changing significantly as industry adapts to kind of the realities of the digital environment as well. And you see this emerging very quickly in the high-income countries. So very different business models are emerging between the pirate marketplace and the former distribution channels, broadcast television, theatrical distribution, that are in some respects being catalyzed by the widespread availability of pirate goods, but are generating these sort of third options for distribution and consumption. And so as the media companies are quickly discovering, they're competing not just with pirated goods now, but with much lower cost licit models. Those, for the most part, don't exist outside the US and Europe. The availability of sort of high-end, the more high-end experimental low-cost media services are really restricted to a handful of high-income markets at this point. And that's something that we want to see change, because they've proven themselves to be relatively effective competitors with piracy when they've been released. That's part of what we see as a necessary evolution of markets for recorded media toward lower-cost offering.
What are some examples of that sort of model?
Oh, any of the streaming services for music or video. I mean, Hulu's an obvious example. Spotify in the UK is only available in the UK, as far as I know, but it's spoken about as a very compelling model for access to music.
And highly anticipated here in the U.S.
Highly anticipated in the U.S. There are some very low-cost rental services now that dramatically undercut not just the sort of blockbuster model, but also the Netflix model and other. You're seeing what I think would be fair to characterize as the end of supernormal profits in the recorded media business, where record companies and in the next few years, I think movie companies as well are going to be unable to effectively control the supply of recorded media, and consequently unable to charge $12 for a CD or $15 for a DVD. I mean, those kinds of pricing strategies are on the way out, and I don't think that's a controversial statement at this point. I think most people in the industry recognize that, and some of them are coming to grips with it and figuring out how to do things differently.
Well, that was an interesting finding. I was surprised looking at your work that across the board internationally, prices for DVDs and CDs and software are typically, you know, along a similar line as they are in the United States. If you look at the price in Argentina and Russia and Nigeria, Brazil, it's along the same lines, or if not more expensive. And looking at the market here in the United States, as you've just given the examples of Hulu and the different ways of getting content, you know, you can get it anywhere from, you know, a full price model to a subscription model to a, you know, free, completely free. It's interesting that the price could be constrained so highly.
Well, the record companies and music companies dominate local markets. For record companies, I think it's in the low 80% for internationally, the four major record labels. For the movie studios, it's comparable. I don't recall the exact number. If you control the production and distribution chain, you can set prices. The constraints on that are where there's a significant local industry that exercises its own sort of price-setting control over its products. And you see that in India, you see that in Nigeria. But for the most part, those local industries are simply too small to have much influence over pricing. So even if it's clearly in their interest to move toward much lower pricing models, they're too embedded in the international sort of production and distribution network to really be able to do that in a significant way.
Well, let's look at enforcement. How are developing countries attempting to contribute to the enforcement of preventing piracy?
All the countries we looked at have very extensive enforcement efforts in some areas. And the question of, well, let me qualify that. Most of the countries we looked at, the enforcement business has really expanded in the last decade. So you have much closer cooperation between international industry associations and local police, local judicial systems. The U.S. government gets involved in this in the context of training of judges. WIPO has significant technical training. WIPO is the World Intellectual Property Organization. They participate in the training of local police and judges. There are a lot of organizations working to ensure that there are working enforcement capacities in these countries.
And who are they cracking down on? Are they going after, you know, Joe and Jane consumer, the people who are, you know, buying the one or two DVDs with the fake printing on them?
To date, there's been almost no enforcement directed against consumers. We haven't found any examples of that. There's been quite a bit of, I should say, outside the U.S. The U.S. is the notable exception to that rule. There's been much more enforcement, in contrast, against intermediaries. Street vendors, retail kiosks, retail storefronts, they've really, you know, the primary target of enforcement has been the sort of public-facing retail side. You know, that enforcement in that context takes the form of raids, takes the form of, you know, kind of local-level police investigations, and has been relatively effective in breaking the pattern of low-end retail sale of pirated discs in many countries. It's not clear that it's been effective at reducing the supply of discs. In fact, the collapse in pricing in the last few years in optical discs in these countries suggests that supply has increased dramatically. It's increased because piracy is very hard to it's a very malleable phenomenon, and it reconfigures easily. It has simply taken other forms. It's organized at a much lower level in many cases, so you no longer have established store owners with large displays of pirated discs in their front windows, because those store owners are the most vulnerable to enforcement activity. But you have extensive networks of street kiosks, mobile vendors, people who are much more resilient in the face of police pressure, and much more difficult to prosecute or to dissuade for any length of time. The other side of it is digital distribution. There are the technical infrastructure for digital piracy in most countries is exploding and will continue to grow very quickly, and is predominantly a non-commercial model that completely circumvents anything resembling retail. Increasingly has less and less to do with peer-to-peer. So peer-to-peer file sharing has been the kind of bogeyman of the industries for the last 5 or 6 years, but has a diminishing share of it's only one of several major channels of distribution at this point. It's being complemented by other kinds of download services, file locker sites, streaming sites, and there are many more ways to share a digital file now than there were 10 years ago, and there is, as best we can tell, no effective way of managing that.
Well, it's interesting to hear that there is such a focus on the digital distribution and digital piracy, where some people might think that in developing countries, the personal computer is still a kind of luxury good that isn't making its way around. And broadband, for that matter, getting high-speed internet as well.
Well, there are different time frames for each of those things. Prices of computers have plummeted in the last few years, and they're becoming much more widely available. Broadband is really, in most of the countries we looked at, is right at the beginning of the adoption curve. And there are some significant differences in the pace of that adoption in the different countries. So South Africa, for example, has been in a kind of grace period, I guess, from the perspective of industry with regard to digital piracy, because it sits at the end of a long submarine cable that provides internet service for the whole west coast of Africa, and consequently has very limited bandwidth in and out of the country. Mm. So, rather relatively arbitrary physical facts like the width of the submarine cable that provides you service have significant impacts on the organization of piracy in the country. So South Africa has been a very aggressive enforcer against street piracy and has had relatively little presence of peer-to-peer file sharing or other kinds of file sharing. So South Africa is one of the success stories from the industry perspective. Now, it may be a very fleeting success story, and even on the optical disc side, we were unable to really validate the claim that pirated discs are less available as a result of the enforcement efforts against organized pirate retail. But those two, the two signals of effective enforcement from the industry perspective, at least until recently, have been really legal reform in the streamlining of the process of prosecuting pirates, and the degree of cooperation of the police with local industry officials in raiding suspected vendors. With those two checkboxes crossed, that's typically been the way to buy your way out of any unwanted attention from industry in the USTR. Whether that has any meaningful relationship to the availability of pirated goods is something we just could not determine.
And you've highlighted a few examples of where local industry have kind of embraced the piracy distribution mechanisms.
Well, I'm not sure I'd put it that way exactly. There are a couple examples where local industries have decided that they have to compete with piracy or make use of pirate networks. So there are models of music promotion in a variety of places that rely on pirate distribution channels to circulate what are otherwise legal promotional discs, whose primary purpose is to create audiences for live performance. That's been a fairly successful model in some countries. The Nigerian film industry is a huge producer of home videos, not for theatrical distribution, but for sale through at very low prices to significant numbers of Nigerians and other and export to other African countries. Much of that passes through street vendor level retail, where the discs are sold at very low prices to the street vendors, and they pass them on at low prices to consumers. So there are a variety of ways in which pirate infrastructure ends up providing the basis for legitimate legal activity. And in fact, we've documented a number of cases where illegal production, illegal distribution makes the transition into the illicit economy. That's a fairly common part of the development narrative of many countries, including the U.S.
what would be your kind of advice to the content industries? What should they be doing over the next 5 or 10 years?
Well, it depends on the industry. And some of the question really has to be broken down by industry. As though the exposure to piracy varies greatly from one sector to another, and even within certain sectors like the software sector. The different companies employ different business models that have very different levels of exposure to piracy. It's not clear to me at all that there's a significant problem for software companies who, in our work, have evolved, and according to our findings, have evolved, you know, what is arguably an optimal strategy for how you develop market share in developing countries, where you allow widespread piracy of platform technologies like Windows, and subsequently go after the major institutions like public schools, public agencies, municipalities, large and small companies that are exposed to police action or lawsuits, and integrate them into the legal software economy. That's fairly standard business practice at this point, and we have example after example of it. And it's also quite explicit in the comments of people like Bill Gates and other Microsoft executives who see this as their road to entry into the Chinese market, into other developing markets. It's not clear to us that they'd want it any other way.
And for the music and film industries?
Well, those are different cases. It's the film industry is divided really between theatrical exhibition and DVD sales at this point. We don't see any evidence that there's any threat to theatrical distribution. It's continued to grow in the last decade. More movies are produced than ever before. The DVD business is very likely a different story. I think there will always be a place for recorded media, but it's not going to be anything like the cash cow that it's been for the movie business for the last 20 years. As I indicated, there are already a variety of low-cost or free streaming services that are competing with DVD sales and DVD distribution. The share of those kinds of services, I think, will only continue to grow. And the movie companies will be looking for very different ways of distributing and selling recorded home versions of their products. The record companies are also in a very different position, where if you look at the total revenues of the music business, not just the record companies, but the music business, including performance, by most accounts, it's grown over the last decade, despite a very dramatic collapse in CD sales. So the CD is clearly a doomed artifact of what people call the crisis of the music business is in large part a function of the total dependence of the big four labels on CD sales for their revenues. Other parts of the music business, ticket sales, everything related to live performance has done quite well up until the recent sort of financial crisis, where discretionary income puts the pinch on all, decreases in discretionary income put the pinch on entertainment of all kinds. But the important question from our perspective is what this means to most artists. There will always be examples of artists whose careers and livelihoods are tied to the CD model disproportionately, and who are likely to suffer as the CD becomes goes the way of the LP. Other artists, other kinds of music models are going to look very different. And the role of recorded media as promotional, as a kind of promotional supplement to performances, looks like it will continue to grow.
Well, thank you very much for your time, and I'm looking forward to seeing what comes up.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Joe Karaganis is the Program Director for Media and Democracy at the Social Science Research Council. He is currently helping to complete a book-length report on media piracy. You can find out more about him and his research at our blog, blogs.law.harvard.edu/mediaberkman. This episode of Radio Berkman was produced by me, Daniel Dennis Jones, at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University in Cambridge, Massachusetts.